So without further ado, so we have Silke Wanfertner, who is going to tell us about quantum simulators and analog gravity.
Hello, nice. Thank you. Sorry, that very moment my daughter enters the room. Okay. So thank you very much for having me at that meeting. I think it works fantastically. Exciting talks. And this one will be perhaps a little bit outside the general realm. It's not about quantum gravity per se. It is about simulating quantum field theory processes in the laboratory, and in particular, how you could harvest these simulators to learn about fundamental physics processes through the means of analog gravity experiments. Okay, so what's the overall idea? I mentioned that already briefly, but so the overall goal is to mimic fundamental physics processes, or to investigate fundamental physics processes that occur in situations where both gravitational and quantum physics matter. And here really, it's not just investigate on a piece of paper, the idea is to simulate these processes in the laboratory. On this slide, we have very different systems. So then these are non-gravitational systems. These are, in our case, fluids and superfluids. And what they have in common with gravitational system is, if you look at small perturbations in these systems, sound waves, for example, or surface waves in these systems, if you look at their dynamics, they follow an effective relativistic, have an effective relativistic field theory, meaning they can experience flat and curved space-time geometries as given by the fluid flows in the system. So you have something where the effective field theory can be mapped on quantum field theory in curved spacetimes. And I want to give you three examples of how you can, what kind of processes you can mimic, what are the sort of new science goals set within a larger network collaborations in the UK and some external partners, also including Matthew Johnson from the Perimeter Institute. Okay. Let's get started right away. So the first one I want to talk about is a first order phase transition in quantum field theory in a relativistic setting. And in particular, we're interested in a toy model to simulate the what's called the false vacuum decay in the laboratory. So why is this interesting and where does it come from? So there is this cosmological proposal, could the universe have originated through a vacuum decay. So what does this mean? So assuming that the universe initially was in a vacuum, but it was a false vacuum. And then it starts decaying via some bubble nucleation process from the false into the true vacuum. And so this, in other words, that is a first order relativistic phase transition. This is, from a mathematical perspective, a quite hard problem. It's non-perturbative, non-linear, and it's in the non-equilibrium. So, and perhaps by understanding this process and the dynamics, the time evolution of this could help us also to shed some light of the origin of our universe, or at least to check if this is a viable model to explain how the universe started out. So that first was mentioned, this idea that one could perhaps mimic that in analog gravity simulators. That goes back to 2017, so it's rather recent. A proposal by Fialco and Drummond et al, where they said, well, there is a system that shows the same dynamics. So what is that system they have in mind? So they're working with superfluids, and a particular candidate for superfluid, pure superfluid. So how does it work? That is a Bose-Einstein ultra bosons, highly diluted, cooled down, and they interact with each other, but their interaction is restricted to two-body coalitions, and they only scatter, they don't form molecules. We only assume S-wave scattering. Okay, so you have this you have this two, so you have, let's start from the basic. What is the Bose-Einstein condensate? And what is the relevant aspects to understand how you can get some sort of false vacuum decay coming out of this completely different system? So we have a bunch of bosons that start with just a simple N bosons. And what is happening in this system? Well, if you look at the many-body Hamiltonian here, you have a kinetic term. They're trapped in a potential. This is a many-body quantum system, and they interact with each other, but in this very limited way, as I'm saying. So what's happening when you condense that system, when it forms this condensate, when you further cool it, what is happening, you break a symmetry. So this Hamiltonian has a U1 symmetry. If you take the boson operator and you replace it by the boson operator times some e to the I, some phase, there's a symmetry, it's a spontaneous symmetry. If you condense that system, you break this symmetry. And what it means is that a condensate picks a phase, it picks a random phase. And if you look at the condensate, in fact, is described by the density, it has an amplitude, the density, it's a complex valued field, it has an amplitude, and it has a phase. So, and what it means, if you have a spontaneous symmetry breaking, you know that you have these Nambu-Goldstone bosons, you have massless excitations. So you have sound waves in the system, they have a zero mass term. So now what you can do with this, you can play with this system. So instead of only taking one species, you take two. And you can, physically that can be implemented by simply taking two different Bose-Einstein condensate atoms, bosons in two different hyperfine states. And you can drive transition, which are called Raman transitions, for example, between these hyperfine states. And when you do it and you add this to the Hamiltonian, you see you get this extra term here. And this extra term explicitly breaks this U1 symmetry. And so you still have an overall, a joint symmetry if you replace these two boson operators. You really now have to think of, you have two different kinds of bosons there. These are in the different hyperfine states. And now you have coalitions between them, coalitions within them, but you also have these transitions. And what that does, because this symmetry, now you're free that this mass, you have usually would have two massive excitations, one in each species. You couple this condensate through this Raman transitions. Now you, one of them, because you break this explicit symmetry, this spontaneous symmetry, you break the symmetry explicitly, and now you're allowed to have a massive phonon modes. And the wonderful thing is in this series, I'm struggling a bit. So what's wonderful in this system is now, so you have this phonon modes, right? You have two kinds, a massless and a massive one. But the relative phase, the dynamics of the relative phase, you have the additive phases and the relative phase. These are your two excitations you have in the system. And the relative phase that now exhibits the dynamics that can be mapped onto a Lagrangian exhibiting the sine Gordon Lagrangian. And what it means is, if I'm just like for now, just saying what you can do without just pick a constant coupling rate for these transitions, you can tune the mass term and you can make mass squared positive or negative. If the mass m squared term is positive, you're in a stable, you're here in this potential, here down in this dip. You're down in this dip. And you just have a massive excitation, but you can make this excitation m squared negative, you create a tachyonic field theory, and then of course it would immediately start decaying. It's an instable theory. But what you can do on top of that, you can say, well, if I have this transition rate, but I engineer through a high frequency modulation, so this transition rate has a modulation on it, and what you can do, you can make it metastable. So now this tachyonic field theory becomes metastable here. And when you're on top of this potential in a false vacuum, and that's what you want, and you can study transitions from the false to the true vacuum. And how does this look like? I have this little video here. This is how this would look like. Look at this, this the same idea as with this inverted pendulum. How can you make an inverted pendulum stable? So you have this high frequency modulations, which you can switch on. You look at that pendulum, it is in a stable state on the bottom, but if you try to put it on the top of this potential, it would always roll down, right? So it's stable on the bottom, it's unstable on the top. Things change when you add this high frequency modulation, it becomes stable, and this is what we're interested in. So it's the same principle, but now you have this in a relativistic setting. So these perturbations have an effective experience and an effective Minkowski space-time. Okay. So the first thing, of course, what you need to do is to understand if something like that really is stable. Because what you have is you're driving in a parameter, you have a time-dependent parameter, which is now this modulation frequency. And this modulation frequency is driving a parametric resonance at very high frequencies. So there's some averaging process where this would go away, but in principle, you're having a system that is unstable. And you want to make it stable with a high resonance frequency. Now, of course, you're playing with two edges of a knife here, and you hope that they would turn out to sort of mediate each other. And so what you see here is the first thing we've done in collaboration with Jonathan Braden, Matt Johnson, Herania Paris, Andrew Ponson. We've looked at the stability of these systems. And in particular, if you're not careful in the wrong parameter space, what you see is that you can exhibit Fourier instabilities. And so what you see here in these two pictures is a simulation, a numerical simulation of a two-component Bose-Einstein condensate. And what we're seeing here is this is the system at hand is one-dimensional. It's one plus one-dimensional, one space-dimensional, and the effective space-time geometry is one plus one-dimensional. And what you see is initially everything is blue, it's in the false vacuum, and as time goes on, you see these nucleation processes. And what's happening here, you start in this, I have my screen here, I can't see the pictures here, but what you should see, I'm putting this down a bit, if you see here, you're in this potential dip at the beginning, right? You're in the blue phase, and then you start decaying into the true vacuum. And then what you have, because different, depending on if these two bubbles, when they meet, they're in the same or in different vacuum, you get this different interaction here. But what you have through this BEC simulations, which are the standard techniques applied to study the time evolution of this many-body quantum systems, what you see is that you get a time evolution of your false vacuum decay. And if you're not careful, you get what's on the right-hand side. You also have these Fourier instabilities. These instabilities are growing and they can overshadow the latent dynamics. So for any experimental purposes, and the goal is, and I will talk a little bit about this, how we're going to do this in the lab, is to, of course, to make sure that you get a long-term dynamics out of this simulation so that you can really study the dynamical evolution in these gravity systems. Now, what you can also see here is very nicely, if you start out with zero higher resonance frequency modulation of your coupling rate, what you get here is lambda equals zero. It's just a tachyonic field theory. It starts immediately rolling down the potential and it has a second order phase transition. If you then crank up the amplitude of this modulation frequency, meaning you make the system more and more meter stable, this is more stable, isn't it? Then what you see is that you go from a second to a first order phase transition. But what's very important is, of course, also you have this experimentally tunable parameter that allows you to sort of have rapid nucleation or slower nucleation. And that's also very important because in any experiment, you don't have, always the time luxury to wait for this to just start. You want it to start within your experimental accessible time frame. So, right. Now, what can you do with this? So, of course, it's a nice toy model, might say, but can I really learn something from that? And so the answer here really is that, you can, by stacking several simulations, decay rate to a high precision. And then you can compare them with the quantum tunneling instantons predictions. And surprise, at least from the simulations, that the rates are very similar. And this is because the techniques used in both assume this semi-classical stochastic lattice simulation only capture this classical decay path. So now, of course, we have this real-time simulation of this semi-classical interpretation of this false vacuum decay. But now, of course, if you compare that to actual experiments, you can see if these techniques, which have these limitations, can indeed, describe the physics which will unfold in an experiment, which ultimately is a true quantum system. So now you have a tool, or you have a mechanism to test your toolboxes, your calculational toolboxes, if the approximation will really describe what's going on in an experiment. Of course, there is a caveat here that when you do the experiment, you need to make sure that any deviations thereof are not from because you work with an analog system or some other spurious effects which you're not interested in. But of course, one can characterize these differences carefully, and one can then use this really as a simulator for the false vacuum decay and as to validate our calculational toolboxes. Okay. I almost skipped that. So how could you simulate that in the lab? So so what you need to do in the lab seems like, okay, you need to set up this complicated two-component superfluid, but you need to have extremely high control, and you need to be able to design Hamiltonian needed to implement this effect. Because you're really walking on the edge here. You're really on the edge. You're playing with an instability. So everything needs to be extremely, extremely well controlled. So this is possible thanks to the development in the quantum technology camp in the recent ones, where they developed a so-called box trap, where they can trap and manipulate these ultra-cold atoms to very high precisions. And in fact, if you fancy it, you can even start writing messages using your superfluids, your Bose-Einstein condensate. So in short, like this is a right moment to ask questions to simulate the false vacuum decay, simply because now the quantum technology is readily available to carry out such experiments. Okay, so now we're coming to a different topic. That was one example how you could use quantum simulators to drive fundamental physics research. The second one has just appeared on the archive today and is sort of forming the theoretical foundations for the next effect, which I want to discuss, and that is the observer dependence. So can we have a toy model to investigate the ambiguity between particles versus vacuum states in a controlled laboratory environment? So let's discuss a bit about the observer dependence of the quantum vacuum. So the first thing is, so a uniformly, sorry, I'm moving, this is a bit in the way here for me. Okay, so a uniform, which is also, so the observer dependence, most of you will know this effect as the Andrew effect, the Andrew radiation. So in that states, well, if I have a uniformly, linearly accelerated observer that experience the fluctuations of the Minkowski vacuum as a thermal bath and with a characteristic temperature, which is referred to as the Andrew temperature, and this is given with the formula here at the top. So here you have Kb, Boltzmann constant times the temperature is equal h bar times A, which is the acceleration of your observer, divided by 2 pi, and c is the speed of light in this system, the speed of light in this formula. So when people, there has been a huge amount of theoretical development when it comes to investigating the Andrew radiation. And in particular, what people are always playing with is this Andrew de Witt detector. And the Andrew de Witt detector, you have to imagine, is like this fundamental detector. So most basic detector, which is simply a two-level quantum system that has an energy gap, and you want to see how can you excite the two-level system from one state to another. And what you're, of course, because now you want to look at that in a relativistic setting, and you want to be looking at accelerated observers. So you're assuming they're on smooth time-like trajectories and that are parameterized with a proper time tau. And then, of course, what you also need for your model, if you have a detector, it needs to interact. It needs to interact the vacuum fluctuations. So it needs to have a coupling. And usually what people are considering are simple interaction Hamiltonian, where alpha is simply this coupling constant. Xi, what they usually say, well, is a switching function. And a switching function, you could think of that in physical terms, is like switching really on the detector, coupling on and off. But you also have to say that most of the time, this switching function is sort of facilitating some mathematical aid here, because you want to make sure that you have a smooth way of switching this on, so that when you look at the excitation rates of your if you calculate how your detector responds, you want to make sure that there are no divergences. So for mathematical purposes, people always work with this switching function, which is simply a smooth function. And then you have, of course, this mu here, that is simply the detector's monopole moment. And phi is the field you're coupling to, which is supposed to be in its quantum vacuum state. So this is sort of this interaction Hamiltonian people are usually considering. Now, the caveat, let me just say before I'm getting to the problem, well, in some ways, this is a really fundamental process, because it tells you, even if there is nothing there, absolute vacuum, and you're moving in it, you can still have a sort of a frictional effect. So usually we always have friction of particles. When you move with a certain velocity, you have some frictional effect. Now, this one says here that it's not for constant motion, not an inertial observer, but if you are accelerating, then even the vacuum, the quantum vacuum, sort of gives you some friction which you need to overcome. You will heat up by accelerating through a quantum vacuum state. So now, what the problem is that this annular radiation is very small. So if you plug in the numbers here and for KB and H bar, and C is the speed of light, what you will see is that at annular temperature is ridiculously small. It's 10 to the minus 20 Kelvin per meters per second squared per acceleration. So it seems far too small to be detectable, because where would you get these high acceleration rates from? How would you accelerate a detector one point and without having all the other effects which you have to take into account? So how could you really set up an experiment to detect this effect? And so as a consequence, many of the assumptions that are going in there cannot be tested. And there's a lot of assumptions going in there, and it would be wonderful to test that if there's a system that could actually allow you to see this annular radiation in the lab. And there are many, many fundamental physics questions to be asked, such as back reaction, but also how would multiple detectors interact with each other? And also some of the assumptions put in to calculate this effect, like Dieter balance and so forth. So it would be wonderful to have an experimental implementation thereof. Okay, so let's try to design and set up a toy model for particle detectors in a relativistic setting. So now we need to overcome a few problems.
Note that you have 10 more minutes.
Ah, okay. So I need to really speed up. So, okay. I think I'm fine. So there in an analog system, there is no analog of a relativistic proper time. So that is a problem. However, our solution for that is, well, in fact, if you are not looking at linearly accelerated observers, but if you go to a circular annular effect, so if you move with a constant velocity on a circle, then you also have acceleration, which needed to stay on the circle. And then the proper and the coordinate time are simply related by a time-independent gamma factor. And so hence, you can overcome this problem. Now, the next thing, of course, now we're talking about real experiments. So it's not just writing down any interaction Hamiltonian or any system. You need to find a real laboratory system, a physical system that acts as an effective annular detector. Our solution? So replace a two-level quantum system with an interferometric setup. And have in mind, interferometers are probably the most precise tool, is high-precision metrology tools, as, for example, used for the detection for gravitational waves. So these are very well developed and tested tools for high precision measurements. So to pick up smallest changes, and this is exactly what it is about, because an unrelated detector is to measure very, very small changes related to its acceleration. So, and what we have is interferometric setup, that's a laser or, and this is the next step change you need to make, go away from a two-level quantum system and go to a continuous probing field. And what we will show is that this is a suitable particle detector. And now the last thing, this is naturally resolved using these analogs, because remember we had these ridiculously small temperatures, 10 to the minus 20 Kelvin per acceleration. And now, of course, what happens in these analog systems, the effective speed of light is now replaced by the sound speed in the system. And there you gained 11 orders of magnitude. And that's, of course, fantastic. And that actually helps to make this effect feasible. Okay, I'm running out of time, or I'm running, it should speed up a bit, but let me, I want to make very sure that the idea, I want to explain the basic idea. And the basic idea, so it's an interferometer, and this is a very simple setup. It's really basically classroom physics here. What we have in here is an optical interferometer. So you have an optical interferometer that goes here in the bottom left side, and it goes into a beam splitter. So an optical interferometer that splits and recombines light, and it can measure smallest differences in the different arm lengths the light travels up versus down. So you have different paths the light is going through, and by splitting it and recombining it, you can measure smallest differences in the arm lengths. So assume you have an interferometer which you tune such that on this port here at the end, you have a particle, you have a photodetector, a photodiode here, and let's say I'm tuning my pass length such that when it arrives here, it cancels out. There's this negative interference and you get zero light here. If I'm now inserting a little phase shifter into my interferometer, there's a different refractive index. This will give the light a little phase shift, and therefore you will, depending on the width of your glass, you can measure the width of your glass plate very high and with high accuracy using this interferometric scheme, because you get a little phase shift, and hence this detector will not be in the dark port anymore. But now imagine if I don't put the phase plate in there, but what I'm putting in there, I put a two-dimensional Bose-Einstein condensate. So I have a fluctuating sheet with little quantum fluctuations on top of that. And when this laser light is going through, the BSC, the Bose-Einstein condensate, it has a different refractive index. And when you have little ripples on it, you have a fluctuating refractive index in your system. And this is, of course, the general idea. This is how we measure this. And these fluctuations, these quantum fluctuations, they follow a relativistic field theory. Now, the first thing we had to do, we had to first understand the circular unradiations in 2+1 dimensions. There will be another paper coming out in 2 days on the archive, where we basically investigate in what sense is actually this circular unradiation thermal. And we show that it's roughly thermal. It's thermality, what it means thermal, is that you can simply take this formula, the Unruh formula for the linearly accelerated observer, and replace this A here with simply the acceleration you have on your circular orbit. And we do this for 2+1 dimension. Now, how can you now get these all the pieces together? And this is just very roughly. You have to do the modeling really carefully. So most of the work was really going into doing the detailed work of understanding how big of a phase shift you will get if there's a small quantum fluctuations in there, and if this really becomes a measurable effect. And so what we have the BSC Lagrangian here, we have the electromagnetic field, your laser beam, and so the BSC is here, laser beams is orthogonal to it, and you move it on a circular orbit. All of this can be implemented with suitable optical techniques. And the interaction here is really given through the polarizability of the atoms due to the laser light. And there has to be a lot of technical details going in that don't disturb these quantum systems too much. The actual detection method is much more involved. And so you have this system, and what you do is you have these density fluctuations in your condensate that gives you a fluctuating refractive index for the lights going through. And what you do, you transduce these density fluctuations, your relativistic field theory fluctuations, from the condensate to phase fluctuations in your laser field. And you can map that onto an Hamilton, onto a Lagrangian, which can be seen as theory of the electromagnetic field is a relativistic field. You have the probe field, which is your BSC field, is an effective relativistic field. And you have an interaction Hamilton, you have the interaction term here, and that is of the form of an unrelated detector. And what we are then doing is we're simply look at the signal to noise ratio in the system. And we indeed see that the signal to noise ratio is sufficiently high, where we also take shot noise, which is intrinsically there in the laser due to quantum physics. We take the shot noise into account and make sure that what you get from an acceleration in the system, that you can actually see a difference in the phase fluctuations on your output port. So how many minutes do I have? Do I have another 5 minutes, 3 minutes? Nigel, I cannot hear you.
I have two or 3 minutes.
Okay, let's come to the last one. So these were two examples of how you could, by what is important I have to mention from the anode detectors. Assuming that there's no back action, and I'm making on testing all the assumption that went to in the calculation, getting a confirmation of this effect would really ensure our trust that anode radiation is something that would occur in a gravitational setting. So there are many, many assumptions that need to be tested. So let's move on to the last thing, to the last block. So black hole ring down. So in particular, let's look at analog gravity simulators of the black hole ring down and what could we learn from that. So first of all, what we're interested are rotating black hole geometries. And rotating black hole geometries are very interesting because they have this wonderful horizon structures. They have apparent event horizon, ergo surfaces, light rings, or the circular orbits. So there's lots going on in the gravitational field around them. And of course, all of these things have fundamental physics processes associated to them, such as Hawking radiation, super radiance, and ring down. So rotating black holes are really interesting effects when it comes to physical fundamental processes. Now, and of course, the possibility, if you could set this rotating black hole into a quantum setting, you could try to see what are the quantum signatures or quantum effects beyond Hawking radiation. And this is the final goal, or which I want to talk about. How could you get there, the pathway to look for quantum signatures of rotating black holes beyond Hawking radiation? So what is a black hole ring down? So everyone knows this figure taken from one of the LIGO papers, which simply shows that if two black holes start merging, they merge from a single black hole. And then when the single black hole has formed, it is not quite stable. It has some energy left, some bumps. It has to shine, it has to settle down. And it does so through a black hole ring down. And in particular, in the end states of this process, this is a ring down can be described in the perturbative regime. So these are really characteristic modes, just as if you hit the bell that give you these characteristic modes, they really probe the gravitational field surrounding the black hole. And the question is, how would this ring down look like in the quantum regime? So now I'm speeding up a bit, but what you can do is by looking at stationary draining vortex flows, you can map small excitations around stationary draining black holes in fluids and superfluids. You can map them to scalar fields propagating around rotating black holes. And in particular, what we are looking at are surface waves around a stationary draining vortex flow in the first instance, just simply water draining down to a central drain hole. This is how a system looks like. Picture taken, this warping comes from taking the picture. You have just a big bathtub vortex. In the center, you have a drain hole. You feed in the water in a way that gives it an angular momentum. We developed some detection methods to map out the free surface, the air-water surface. That's simply because that is the effective field theory we want to study. And by mapping that over time, we can get all the necessary information of how fluctuations behave around this analytic rotating black hole. So how does wave propagation look like around this hydrodynamic black hole? You send in waves in this vortex flow, the waves interact with this, and you see that there is a distortion of these water waves, which simply comes about because they are propagating on an effective 2+1 dimensional space-time geometry where there is a rotating black hole in the center. Now, one of the things you can directly do, you can say, well, if I stimulate that with a coherent monochromatic waves, then I get this different at different frequencies, I get this different, these wonderful wave patterns. And then, of course, one should be able to predict how these wave patterns propagate by simply calculating the geodesics in this analog space-time setting. So we use standard techniques to calculate these ray tracings. I'm just skipping these slides and go ahead. So what this also predicts is that there should be circular orbits. And the circular orbits are for waves counter-rotating or co-rotating in two different sets of circular orbits. And what you have to all have in mind with these orbits is these are the separating the waves that fall inside or the waves that escape. And just in between the two, there's these circular orbits where in principle, if you would look at particles, particles could hover forever. So there's something that was trapping the waves. So these are these equilibrium points in the radial direction or critical points in the Hamiltonian. And what you can do with this circular orbits, you can calculate these ring down modes. And the ring down has a real part, which is given by the circular orbit, and it has an imaginary part, which is how it decays off. And that is also given through the boundary conditions. Then we can compare, of course, with these geodesic motions in our system, how well we can actually track this these wave fronts if we use this this geometrical understanding of how this wave should propagate. And that works rather well. So that gave us this idea, well, look, if you have these circular orbits and they predict this ring down, we should actually in any non-equilibrium effect in around vortex flow, you should have a black hole ring down. So what we looked at, we basically kicked our vortex flow, we called it an unruh vortex, we brought it into unrest. And then we waited it for it to settle down. And what we noticed already, there was a lot of noise on that free surface. And the question is this noise actually black hole ring down noise? So what we did a careful analysis of that, and what we've seen, there were some characteristic frequencies excited up to very high angular momentum. And then we had to refine our prediction for these ring down modes, working with effective field theories that incorporate higher spatial derivatives. So we had to go from, work with more complicated dynamical equations, which in the limit reduced to the ones you get around a rotating black hole. And what we could see that there was an excellent match between the antimodal frequency we're looking at and which what is the frequency of the excited mode. So what we've seen is that, okay, what was an open question, how does this real part of the frequency depend on the boundary condition of the system? And it seems that they're not affected, but one could actually play around with that and simply bring the boundaries closer in to see when this breaks down. We also noticed that these ring down modes are endpoints of the non-equilibrium process, but we also noticed that the ring down modes are persistent almost in the full non-equilibrium, and full please in quotation marks, but what we notice that they appear far from equilibrium. And now we want to understand how we can actually refine our theoretical models to have this prediction all the way, how you can calculate ring down modes far from equilibrium. Now, and also what we noticed, if you do a more careful modeling of the theoretical setup, the effective field theory is quasi-involved. You have prediction from quasi-bound states, which simply comes about if you take the vortex core physics into account, you have a scalar field that accumulates a mass term when it's close to the center. So you have like almost like an axion-like field, which has local mass, which can be accumulated close to the vortex strain. So, and now I really, 1 minute and I stop. So that's all really nice. And that gave us a wonderful idea. So since this is such a robust concept, why don't we push this into a regime where we don't know anymore how this ring down would work? Why don't we take this ring down and take it out of its classical setting? So if you want to make something quantum, you have to make it small and cold. And in fact, both go hand in hand. So you really need to, in order to eliminate all the thermal noise in the system, you need to make it not just very, very cold, you need to make it very small. So what we are the current having, we're having sort of this three-step approach. We are sort of in the middle now. We're working still with the classical system, but just to get some idea of how to set up the superfluid. And what we're working with is superfluid helium, and this is our picture via cryostatic inset. And the idea is to really turn this down onto nanoscales, onto a fluidic chip, nanofluidic chip for superfluid helium. And what we want, what we get at every step, we get a little bit more quantum out of this. So in the middle step, we still have a system where the fluctuations are mainly classical, but what you have, you get a discrete, a quantized angular momentum. And what we're currently doing, there's a big effort of understanding what it would mean to have a ring down process in the quantum regime. How would the discretization of the angular momentum affect the black hole ring down? And I don't want to give too much away, but we have some first results. And it's quite beautiful how with low quantum numbers of this vortex flow, you already get a beautiful ring down behavior. So this is what we are doing at the moment. And of course, eventually the idea would be that you really put this quantized angular momentum into a fully quantum environment, interacting with a quantized relativistic field theory. And that's a matter of further control and getting the system colder. So who are we? So this is a lot of work, and I want to end with this. We've just been awarded a large network grant in the UK. People I mentioned already from the PI, Matt Johnson is involved, Bill Unruh, Jörg Schmidmeier, Ralf Schützold are external collaborators, and of course, Jonathan Braden as well. So these are externals, the rest is all UK-based. We've just gotten a huge network grant to attack these three problems. And hopefully at the end of all this, we'll have some new insights for fundamental physics through analog simulations. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you very much. So questions? I'm looking at the list of participants. Whoever is raising, please raise your hand or use the chat, whichever you prefer. Questions for Silke? Michael? Michael, please unmute yourself. Or, yes, go ahead.
Hey. Great. I had a question concerning your third setup. Where you were considering that black hole, and you were saying that you can think of different trajectories in your water basin. But if I think of a trajectory, I'm normally in the iconal approximation, right? Where the wavelength is much smaller than the geometry I'm looking at. But here in this water basin, I guess your wavelength of these water waves is quite of a similar order as your black hole. Could you a little bit elaborate how you match the trajectories to the wave patterns that you see in the end?
Okay, so first, when you say the size of your black hole, you would say what you want to have, if you want to calculate, if you use this ray tracing techniques, what you're working in a WKB approximation also, where you want to say that you have a separation in terms of how much does you have a rapidly changing phase and a slowly changing amplitude. So one of the situations you need to carefully look at is, for example, if you have an adiabatic process or non-adiabatic process. So for example, what you cannot calculate with these methods is, for example, if you have processes like superradiance, how the amplitude's really changing. You can go to next order to look at that. So one of the things why these techniques are not perfect is because we are looking at situations that are highly non-adiabatic. So if you really look carefully at our comparison, you will see that it's going rather well. The wavefronts match nicely with the experimental data. But if you really look after they interacted with the vortex flow, the match is not that great. And this is simply also because you're in a non-adiabatic situation. So, and then of course you need to, in general, look at the scales when your approximation scheme is valid. And there are two arguments. So it turns out that this WKB approximations with some refinements actually turns out to be a relatively good approximation with some caveats. So it is an approximation and will not capture everything. But if you look at the scales involved, you can apply quite well. So you have to go through your arguments and make sure that it's valid and we are simply in the validity. It's really about the size. It's here is how rapid does the background change.
Okay, thank you, Silke and Michael. Other questions for Silke? So let me ask one question. So this thing with the higher derivatives, do you see any signature of them in your waveforms, or are everything just consistent with the lowest order derivative?
No. So if you look at this curve, so what we have here on this, the green ones are the data, and the orange dashed ones. The orange dashed ones is basically the theory prediction where we measure the fluid flow separately, so we know what the effective gravitational field is and we put it in. You wouldn't get a good match if you don't take dispersive effects into account. So we really have to work with a full dispersion relation. If you don't do it, you cannot make a match. Because we are operating this due to the size constraint of our system, we're operating this at we're operating with the waves we're sending in are short wavelengths modes. Mm-hmm. And so they are in the dispersive regime. In a way, most of what we're seeing here, or a large part of this spectrum here, because the frequencies here are quite high. Mm-hmm. And so that means they're in the dispersive regime. So in fact, it would reveal that you have, you couldn't match it if you wouldn't take the deviation into account.
Orange and black look very similar.
I should have used a different graph. So the black is, if there are two ways to go about. You could say, look, there's something going out. I hope it doesn't outside the street. But so you measure this ring down mode, and you measure that in a different antimodal number and the frequency, and you just plot them. And then you could say, let me make an independent measurement and measure the fluid flow. So try to extract information to what the effective gravitational potential is. And then with this effective gravitational potential, I can actually make a prediction for this mode. And then you get the orange dashed line and the green line, they need to agree. Suppose you couldn't make that background measurement. If I just had my ring down modes, the spectrum of my ring down modes, could I find out what the effective gravitational field is? Mm-hmm. And so the best match by letting the background parameters vary, that would give you this black line. So it's sort of like, can I use these methods to learn about my fluid flow? In the same sense as we want to use the gravitational wave arriving here in the ring down to learn about the gravitational field. So if you couldn't make the other measurement, this is you would find the parameters. You could also find the fluid parameters that way.
So thanks a lot, Silke. That's interesting. So just one last question since we are over time. So Astrid, do you want to go ahead and unmute yourself?
Yeah, sorry, I can't raise my hand as a co-host. Okay. So I'm just wondering, you had Ruth Gregory on your final slide, who's been working on seeded vacuum decay from black holes. So probably a very naive question, but is there some way you could test this in an Anabox setup?
Thank you. It's a wonderful question. Yes, in fact, the first thing we want to do is to start with a seeded one. So Ruth is on the program, and she has done significant work also with Ian Moss on the seeded false vacuum decay. And indeed, this will be implemented in Cambridge by Soren Hadjibabic, who is doing the experiments. And the first idea will be to look at the seeded false vacuum decay.
Okay, so wonderful. Thanks, everyone. And thank you. Let's thank Silke again.